rest in the New Testament. Here's my key point. The second generation of Christians, those who did not see, touch, and therefore did not remember Jesus, they could not recognize Jesus. They could only believe in him. I'll say that again. I want to make it really strongly. They never knew Jesus. They couldn't recognize him. They too, the second generation, people like Timothy, people like Luke who wrote our gospel, they too had their religious experience. Every human being does. They too had a call and a wonder and a cry and a hope and a religious journey happening in them. Who doesn't? They too lived within the framework of faith. But when they spoke about their experience and when they spoke about their forgiving, being forgiven, and when they spoke and shared in the mystery of the church's life in the Kyrie eleison and in the Eucharist and broke bread with this lovely community, how these Christians love one another, they didn't know what was happening to them. They needed Peter to say, this is what's happening to you. It's Jesus. It's not just God in some mysterious, ephemeral kind of numinous way. It's Jesus. It's his spirit. Now, Timothy can either believe that or disbelieve it. There is choices. He believed it because Peter was just so convincing. Peter was just such a beautiful person. The life of the community was so real, and when they lived out this belief, it made sense. It made sense of their religious experience. It enlarged their environment. It had the fruit of more love. It had the fruit of more meaning. And, well, we're in our world. We can't know everything. We've got to spend most of our time believing other people. Well, then, surely the people we're going to believe are going to be those who, tested, show themselves to be most trustworthy. Not to believe is to be fixed where I am, going nowhere. To believe can be foolish or wise. The second generation of Christians found it wise to believe, and in their believing they found a fruit, a life that proved itself in the living. And this concludes my first point. There is some knowledge that you have which is personally generated through the reflection on your own personal experience, and in religious matters, on your own personal religious experience. For example, Moses experienced the Exodus. It happened to him, the burning bush, the mountain experience, the journey. He was there. He reflected on all that experience, and it had meaning for him in the light of the world in which he lived, and he expressed it as best he could in the law and organization and so on. Secondly, John knew Jesus. He was there on the lake or on the mountain or talking with him. Had all those marvelous encounters, and that led him to know a lot about Jesus. On the other hand, we have the area of belief. Belief which is based by definition on trust of another person's insights and that other person's communicated knowledge, or it could be indirectly communicated belief. But belief all goes back to somebody's knowledge, however many generations back it might be. The reasons, why would you trust, why would you believe, why would Polycarp, the men we're going to look at today, Justin Martyr, why would he believe John, why would the second generation believe the first? Well, I'm only suggesting a few reasons that come to my mind. You could have better ones yourself easily. Firstly, when the witness is very convincing, when the doctor knows what he's doing, when he does the operation very well 100% of the time, and he's the best around, you'd be sensible to believe him. When what you're asked to believe is consistent with all that you do know. There's another big thing, isn't it? If the person says something, but you know something that contradicts us, you don't believe them, do you? Please God, I hope you don't. Because you've got a check there, and you say, well, he might be beautiful, wise, but he doesn't know my situation, because I'm there. I can't accept that statement. Thirdly, when you live out your belief and it makes sense, the next step rolls on. The next step is wiser, more beautiful, more integrating, more truthful, more demanding perhaps, but the fruit comes on the tree, so you know the fertilizer is good. And so to conclude, the New Testament then, in all the journeys of this 6 weeks, will remain basic to everything they say and everything they do. It will remain normative because the New Testament alone contains knowledge of Jesus. They were the ones who experienced him and so could know that their insights were about Jesus. Later tradition, scripture and tradition, you see what I'm talking about here, later tradition are simply later interpretations, later insights into the meaning of Jesus based on the prior insights of the scripture and the record there of the experiences which ground those interpretations. So there's my first point, simply with you. Why the New Testament is going to remain basic. My second point will take us into another factor. While the New Testament will remain basic, it isn't enough. We need to go beyond it. I've already said that. I would now like to establish as clearly as I can, not the whole thing, because that's what we'll be doing in the next few weeks, but what is the key factor that emerges in the change? What needed to happen? I've noted there for you that the pressure came from the Greek inquiry. The church was born within the horizon of the Jewish world. The language of the New Testament is basically, with a few ramifications, but basically Semite. The images they use are Semitic. It's like the language of our catechisms comes out of what we'll call, if I may use the word, European, perhaps culture, speaking very generally. That's the language we use. One wouldn't expect an Aboriginal to find that language very useful, would you? Because it's coming out of another world, another images, another whole horizon of thinking that's totally other than his or her world. When the Greek world came to the New Testament book and came to the New Testament people, they came with their own agenda, their own questions, their own life, their own horizon. And the Greek world, putting this awfully briefly, I feel terrible, but anyway, I haven't got time to do anything but brief. The Greek world had developed tools for inquiry which were unknown in the Semitic world. The Greek world was trying to control meaning. The Greek world had seen through the kind of cosmologies of religion, where religion was bound up in the eternal cycles of the weather and sexuality and whatever, and the seasons and so on, where it was all, what you did was all totally circular and went on and on and on and gave you no freedom to make your future. You were bound in by the gods and by destiny and all that. The Greeks made those first decisive and terribly important steps to break out of myth and magic and to center, in one sense, on man, to recognize that man, woman, has a possibility of knowing, not just believing everything, but actually discerning. They developed scientific method. They developed ways of logic. They developed ways of inquiry. They developed technical language of philosophy to try to actually analyze and know what you know. Am I going all right? Just generally to that's the world in which they lived. When they came to Christianity, they had to ask, what do you mean? For example, eat my flesh. John chapter 6. Eat my flesh and drink my blood. Beautiful words, if you're a Hebrew. Beautiful words if you've known Jesus. Beautiful words if you've sat with him. These are the words of poetry. These are the words of drama. These are the words of music. These are the words of art. These are symbolic words that are close to images and imagination and keep a close link with memory and historical encounter and experience. That's what symbolic language is about. Very close to the experience, and it takes our heart. It does all those things, doesn't it? And the take up your cross. Take up your cross. You took up your cross when you came here tonight, but I can't see it. I mean, what do you mean by cross? I might ask if I was a Greek. If you were someone who knew Jesus and was stood there when he was crucified, you wouldn't need to be asked, would you? Because you kind of, well, you think you know what you mean. At least you've got a grasp of the meaning of it within that image held there symbolically for you. And so on, when you call Jesus the Son of God, as John does, or the Word of God, a Greek would say, I like what you say, it sounds terrific, it stirs me, but what are you saying? What do you mean by it? The language of the New Testament is primarily and almost exclusively symbolic. It's almost exclusively symbolic. It keeps link with imagery and sense perception. It stores the experience in the story. The insight is there, and it's contained in the very narrative, in the parable, in the episode. Symbolic language expresses truth in a way that touches human sensibility and fires our imagination and engages our affection, stirs our will. And in fact, it is the most appropriate vehicle for communicating truth. It's love talk. And it is the most appropriate vehicle for communicating truth to the whole person. However, the Greek mind, rightly, and we've benefited from it, came at all that quite capable of understanding symbolism, yes, except that they had a different frame of reference for a lot of it, but they were asking for explanatory language. What does it mean? They are asking the question of intelligence. They are asking to pin it down in some way and control it and be able to explain it. And so the greatest need after the New Testament was precisely to develop a language which went across cultures, which was free from imagery, as free as possible, which was tight, technical, clear, and that a mind who explored the definitions could understand without all the body, imagination, memory implications of symbolic language. Difficult task. It may even prove to be ultimately impossible to get it complete. But that was the journey that they were on, and it had to happen, or the whole Hebrew world could never have entered into a whole Greek mentality. It would have been locked. The only way to be a Christian would have been to be a Jew, to grasp the meaning of the New Testament. And so that was the thing, pushing towards a development of explanatory language. And that's the kind of language we're going to, those of you who persevere, are going to find in the next weeks building up to the Council of Nicaea, for example. My third point I'd like to make with you, the first is that the New Testament remained normative because it alone had knowledge of Jesus as distinct from belief in him. The second point is that a movement had to go outside the imagery and symbolism of the New Testament if ever the meaning of the good news was going to communicate to the world. And the first time that happened, I hope you can already, if your head's buzzing in the same direction as mine, is can't you see how it's got to happen again in our time, for our world? In fact, it's got to happen in every generation. You can't just repeat the words of yesterday, however sacred, to people of today, because the horizon has changed. That aside, put aside, the first big, initial, difficult effort to do that was done at this time. And so My third point with you is, why stop at Chalcedon? One, because I'll get worn out if we don't. Two, because you can't keep coming for the rest of your life. And three, because I think by the time Chalcedon comes, the main lines of this have been established. And my desire, for those of you who are here, for myself primarily, I presume, and for you, is to make a link between the Jesus of the Gospel, who's totally beautiful and attractive, and the Jesus of the Nicene Creed, whom you might be forgiven for wondering if it was the same Jesus. When you say your creed, the language is so different from any of the Gospels, isn't it? And the language of catechisms seem to be so different from the Gospels. I want to show you that it's the same Jesus, but shifting from different language patterns. And hopefully, therefore, the Nicene Creed will be something you might sing as you go to bed every night from now on, kind of thing. It might. Basically, then, the symbolic language of the New Testament reflects the Semitic world in which Jesus lived and those who first came to know him. The Greek desire for clarity demanded of the Christian world more than sincerity. They were attracted by the sincerity. That's lovely. They were attracted by holiness, of course. They were attracted by consistency of life, all those things. But the Greek mind, sometimes perhaps proudly, but basically correctly, was looking for technical, clearly defined terminology to explain exactly what do you mean. As we go through these weeks, I'm just preparing you now rather rapidly before I conclude this first section, we find pile up of misunderstanding. People using words wrongly, false, undetected assumptions they've got when they come to it, and they end up in heresy somewhere for that reason, probably. People using the same words with different definitions. It's a very difficult scientific beginning of exploration of what will emerge in what we call theology or doctrines of the church. Very interesting period, fascinating study, but quite a difficult journey, because they're trying to do it in areas of wonderful mystery and sacred encounters of faith and Eucharist and so on. In a church that's rapidly growing and reaching across more and more cultures all the time. So it's a very difficult process, as I hope you can understand. The tools that they were using, and this is an interesting study too for those of you who might be, the Greek mind that came to Christianity learnt far more than Christianity learnt. In fact, the development of philosophy was through this encounter. The mysteries of faith and the mysteries of religious experience, in fact, exploded the Greek mind. And the mind had to grow. The tools of inquiry were too blunt and too imperfect. And it was the encounter of the faith experience and the Christian worship and the actual lifestyle and living out of by Christians that brought philosophy a more and more and more refinement over the centuries. And we'll see plenty of that happening. My aim with you, to limit it, is we can't do the whole thing terribly thoroughly. Well, I hope to do it fairly thoroughly, but not exhaustively, clearly. What I'll be looking for as I journey through the first 450 years of the church's life, and what I'll be trying to share with you in the nights to come, starting tonight, is not all the points, which are far too complex, but I've really searched, I promise you that, to try to see the line, the thrust, the prevailing and consistent movements in the hypotheses that they developed and the way they looked at it and the language they developed and so on. The consistent movements and the constant elements of faith and belief that pervaded. Certain things keep coming back and back and back. And if we watch those things that keep coming back, and the light that keeps coming, and the things they refuse to accept, that center line, we're getting very much in touch with what they believed Jesus to be. And that's our question. And if we can touch that, well, we then either believe it or we don't believe it, but we know what we're believing. When we can ground our belief, not only on the New Testament beauty of symbolic and consistent language too, and the wealth of it all, but on the persistent, 400 years all over the place of people coming back to radical positions in regard to Jesus that we'll find, that underpin the attempts at definition. Finally, to conclude before you take a break, and I've written this text down for you on your sheet, but let me read it to you now. This is the statement of John the 23rd at the opening of the Second Vatican Council exactly 20 years ago, not to the day but to the year. The Christian, Catholic and apostolic spirit of the whole world, he said to that group of people, expects a step forward towards a doctrinal penetration and a formation of consciousness in faithful and perfect conformity to the authentic doctrine, which I've been speaking about, which, however, should be studied and expounded through the methods of research and the literary forms of modern thought. And he made a magnificent distinction here, which you've got to keep in mind. The substance of the ancient doctrine of the deposit of faith is one thing. The way it's presented is another. And it is to the latter, the communication, that careful and, where necessary, patient consideration must be given, everything being measured according to the requirements of a teaching authority which is predominantly pastoral in character. The second generation church could not find it sufficient to simply repeat the New Testament, because they were talking to people who weren't New Testament people. They had to find words that met their world and christened their world and brought the good news to another people with another worldview and another system of belief, if you like, another surrounding horizon of wherever they were. And it would both interact with that culture and learn from the culture. There had to be that interface between the two all the time, or there'd never have been a conversion of the world. And it was a pastoral, it was a love act. It was because when you talk to someone, you use their language. You try and talk to them in ways they understand. I hope I'm not making too much of a mess of it myself tonight. That's up to you. Anyhow, this is the hardest bit. But that's at least the attempt has to be made. And we have to make the attempt again today. What I'm going to do with you after this break is begin to look at what did they do and what were the basic directions and thrust of that first 400 years when they tried in their pastoral love to preach the good news to a changing church and changing world.